and the few of us who were still any good but stayed on were only those who'd been there too long. In the old days, nobody ever quit the 20th century, and somehow we couldn't make ourselves believe that it was gone. After a while, we couldn't quit, because no other employer would have us, for which I can't blame him. Nobody would deal with us in any way, no respectable person or firm. All the small shops where we traded started moving out of Starnesville fast, till we had nothing left but saloons, gambling joints, and crooks who sold us trash at gouging prices. The alms we got kept falling, but the cost of our living went up. The list of the factory's needy kept stretching, but the list of its customers shrank. There was less and less income to divide among more and more people. In the old days, it used to be said that the 20th century motor trademark was as good as the carat mark on gold. I don't know what it was that the Starnes heirs thought, if they thought at all. But I suppose that, like all social planners and like savages, they thought that this trademark was a magic stamp which did the trick by some sort of voodoo power, and that it would keep them rich as it had kept their father. Well, when our customers began to see that we never delivered an order on time and never put out a motor that didn't have something wrong with it, the magic stamp began to work the other way around. People wouldn't take a motor as a gift if it was marked 20th century. And it came to where our only customers were men who never paid and never meant to pay their bills. But Gerald Starnes, doped by his own publicity, got huffy and went around with an air of moral superiority, demanding that businessmen place orders with us, not because our motors were good, but because we needed the orders so badly. By that time, a village halfwit could see what generations of professors had pretended not to notice. What good would our need do to a power plant when its generators stopped because of our defective engines? What good would it do to a man caught on an operating table when the electric light went out? What good would it do to the passengers of a plane when its motor failed in midair? And if they bought our product, not because of its merit, but because of our need, would that be the good, the right, the moral thing to do for the owner of that power plant, the surgeon in that hospital, the maker of that plane? Yet this was the moral law that the professors and leaders and thinkers had wanted to establish all over the earth. If this is what it did in a single small town where we all knew one another, do you care to think what it would do on a world scale? Do you care to imagine what it would be like if you had to live and to work when you're tied to all the disasters and all the malingering of the globe? To work, and whenever any men failed anywhere, it's you who would have to make up for it? To work with no chance to rise, with your meals and your clothes and your home and your pleasure depending on any swindle, any famine, any pestilence anywhere on earth. To work with no chance for an extra ration till the Cambodians have been fed and the Patagonians have been sent through college. To work on a blank check held by every creature born by men whom you'll never see, whose needs you'll never know, whose ability or laziness or sloppiness or fraud you have no way to learn and no right to question. Just to work, and work, and work, and leave it up to the Ivies and the Geralds of the world to decide whose stomach will consume the effort, the dreams, and the days of your life. And this is the moral law to accept? This, a moral ideal? Well, we tried it, and we learned. Our agony took 4 years, from our first meeting to our last, and it ended the only way it could end, in bankruptcy. At our last meeting, Ivy Starnes was the one who tried to brazen it out. She made a short, nasty, snippy little speech in which she said that the plan had failed because the rest of the country had not accepted it, that a single community could not succeed in the midst of a selfish, greedy world, and that the plan was a noble ideal, but human nature was not good enough for it. A young boy, the one who had been punished for giving us a useful idea in our first year, got up as we all sat silent and walked straight to Ivy Starnes on the platform. He said nothing. He spat in her face. That was the end of the noble plan, end of the 20th century. The man had spoken as if the burden of his years of silence had slipped suddenly out of his grasp. She knew that this was his tribute to her. He had shown no reaction to her kindness. He had seemed numbed to human value or human hope. But something within him had been reached, and his response was this confession. This long, desperate cry of rebellion against injustice, held back for years, but breaking out in recognition of the first person he had met, in whose hearing an appeal for justice would not be hopeless. It was as if the life he had been about to renounce were given back to him, by the two essentials he needed, by his food and by the presence of a rational being. "But what about John Galt?" she asked. "Oh," he said, remembering. "Oh, yes. You were going to tell me why people started asking that question." "Yes." He was looking off as if at some site which he had studied for years, but which remained unchanged and unsolved. His face had an odd, questioning look of terror. "You were going to tell me who was the John Galt they mean, if there ever was such a person." "I hope there wasn't, ma'am. I mean, I hope that it's just a coincidence, just a sentence that hasn't any meaning." "You had something in mind." "What?"
It was something that happened at that first meeting at the 20th Century Factory. Maybe that was the start of it, maybe not, I don't know. The meeting was held on a spring night 12 years ago. The 6,000 of us were crowded on bleachers, built way up to the rafters of the plant's largest hangar. We had just voted for the new plan, and we were in an edgy sort of mood, making too much noise, cheering the people's victory, threatening some kind of unknown enemies, and spoiling for a fight, like bullies with an uneasy conscience. There were white arc lights beating down on us, and we felt kind of touchy and raw. And we were an ugly, dangerous mob in that moment. Gerald Starnes, who was chairman, kept hammering his gavel for order, and we quieted down some, but not much. And you could see the whole place moving restlessly from side to side, like water in a pan that's being rocked. "This is a crucial moment in the history of mankind," Gerald Starnes yelled through the noise. "Remember that none of us may now leave this place, for each of us belongs to all the others by the moral law which we all accept." "I don't," said one man and stood up. It was one of the young engineers. Nobody knew much about him. He'd always kept mostly by himself. When he stood up, we suddenly turned dead still. It was the way he held his head. He was tall and slim, and I remember thinking that any two of us could have broken his neck without trouble. But what we all felt was fear. He stood like a man who knew that he was right. "I will put an end to this once and for all," he said. His voice was clear and without any feeling. That was all he said, and started to walk out. He walked down the length of the place in the white light, not hurrying and not noticing any of us. Nobody moved to stop him. Gerald Starnes cried suddenly after him, "How?" He turned and answered, "I will stop the motor of the world." Then he walked out. We never saw him again. We never heard what became of him. But years later, when we saw the lights going out one after another in the great factories that had stood solid like mountains for generations, when we saw the gates closing and the conveyor belts turning still, when we saw the roads growing empty and the stream of cars draining off, when it began to look as if some silent power were stopping the generators of the world and the world was crumbling quietly like a body when its spirit is gone, then we began to wonder and to ask questions about him. We began to ask it of one another, those of us who had heard him say it. We began to think that he had kept his word, that he, who had seen and known the truth we refused to know, was the retribution we had called upon our heads, the avenger, the man of that justice which we had defied. We began to think that he had damned us, and there was no escape from his verdict, and we would never be able to get away from him. And this was the more terrible because he was not pursuing us. It was we who were suddenly looking for him, and he had merely gone without a trace. We found no answer about him anywhere. We wondered by what sort of impossible power he could have done what he had promised to do. There was no answer to that. We began to think of him whenever we saw another collapse in the world, which nobody could explain, whenever we took another blow, whenever we lost another hope, whenever we felt caught in this dead gray fog that's descending all over the earth. Perhaps people heard us crying that question, and they did not know what we meant, but they knew too well the feeling that made us cry it. They too felt that something had gone from the world. Perhaps this was why they began to say it, whenever they felt that there was no hope. I'd like to think that I'm wrong, that those words mean nothing, that there's no conscious intention and no avenger behind the ending of the human race. But when I hear them repeating that question, I feel afraid. I think of the man who said that he would stop the motor of the world. You see, his name was John Galt.